Welcome to the Collide Podcast. We're a growing community of everyday chicks colliding with Jesus in our mess, our pain, our joy, and our stories. We value showing up as we truly are, so that's what you'll find here. Walls and masks being torn down so that we can allow Jesus to meet us where we truly are and hear about other women doing the same. We can't wait to collide with you.
After I had suffered a pretty tremendous loss and that I was a widow at age 44, the thing that actually started me dreaming again was to begin to plant a small little garden. And all I had was a little raised garden bed in Seattle. I didn't have much space, but I grew radishes, which are very easy to grow here in the Pacific Northwest. And harvesting that radish, tasting that radish, I can't explain it except to say that nourish hope in me.
Welcome to the We Collide Podcast. I'm Willow Weston, the founder and director of Collide, and I am so excited today to have Margaret Manning Scholl on the podcast. Margaret has served as a pastor, an international speaker, and a writer for the better part of 20 years. She's a lifelong learner and studied psychology, theology, and biblical languages in her undergraduate work and then on to graduate school and completed her Master's of Science in Clinical Mental Health Counseling at Western Washington University. And Margaret is now serving as a counselor in private practice in Bellingham, Washington. She works with clients with a range of issues from all walks of life, but has a particular interest in working with individuals who are going through grief and loss. Whether that grief comes from the loss of a loved one, the loss of expectations and dreams for one's life, the loss of faith, or the pain of infertility, Margaret is doing amazing work with people. And so we're so excited to have you on the podcast today. I just love and admire the work that you do. And I'm hoping to have a conversation today with you about women and their desire for wholeness. So much of the work that we do here at Collide sees women who are struggling and feel broken and have their past chasing them and battling insecurities and just desiring healing in their life. I'm seeing women who are desiring health and change. And I know that you get so many clients, Margaret, coming to you with these same issues. And so I just kind of thought about six different topics that women seek help for. And I'm hoping to have you throw back at me your best advice for those of us seeking help in those areas. Are you cool to do that? So the first one I want to talk about is self-care. How are you seeing women struggling to make time for self-care, and why is self-care so important?
Well, I think part of the reason why we struggle so much with self-care is I think we generally as women feel that taking time for ourselves is selfish, that it equals selfishness. And that's really not the case. We cannot, you know, women are natural, I think, for the most part, carers and nurturers. And in order to do that work, that kind of gifting that we have, we are naturally interested in connection and in serving others and in being a part of others' lives. We have to take the time to take care of ourselves. And in order to do that, we've got to get rid of this notion that self-care is selfish. I think the other reason why it's so important is that if we don't take care of ourselves and we're constantly caring for others, and we're going to talk about this, I think, a little bit later, is just the way in which that leads to burnout, to depression, to anxiety, to other kinds of more mental health issues that we struggle with if we're not taking care of ourselves. I think also, Willow, sometimes our idea of self-care is somewhat unrealistic. We think we've got to take a huge, to care for ourselves is to take out a huge chunk of our time to get away. And I think one of the keys is to try and cultivate many sort of what I call self-care pauses during the day. And just to take a few minutes to stop, as it were, smell the roses, get outside for a second, feel the sunshine wherever you are. These little kinds of things, just noticing our breath even, that sustains us, that's always there, we forget about it. These are just little ways that we can sort of begin to cultivate practices of self-care. And it starts with these pauses that I think are so important.
I love that challenge, because I know for me, and I'm assuming I'm not the only one, it's so easy to run from, you know, my morning starts out with, you know, get up, make breakfast for the kids, get their lunches ready, take a shower, check my email, take the kids to school, get out the door, go to work, like fit as much as I possibly can in my workday before I have to go back and pick the kids up for school and drive them to gymnastics, drive them to football, drive it. Then I got to go make the dinner. And then while I'm making the dinner, I'm going to check more email because then the kids are going to be home. And then, you know, and it's just like you do all this and then you realize, oh my gosh, I haven't even gone outside. I didn't stop and sit and eat breakfast or lunch. I mean, it's like women are almost feel all this pressure to be super women and go, go, go and do, 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 that we so often do just that and don't pause.
Yeah. And I think rather than making women feel more guilty than they already do for having to lead very busy lives, very full lives, I think the thing is to say, knowing that we have these kinds of schedules, generally speaking, what we can do, that's what we need to think about, is what can I do in the midst of a very busy schedule to give myself that little self-care pause, to even just take our hands, put them on our heart, put them, you know, on our head, wherever we need just that gentle touch, and just to say, you know, I'm loved, I can get through this, I'm doing the best that I can. Just those little encouragements that we so easily give to others, but we have such a difficult time extending to ourselves. We wouldn't tell a good friend of ours who's super busy and who's struggling, you know, buck up and get over it. But that's what we tell ourselves. And so to cultivate, you know, really a stance of self-compassion is really the start, I believe, of true self-care.
I love that you're challenging our notion that self-care is not selfishness, and that we need to take self-care pauses and be compassionate with ourselves a little bit.
You know, we laugh, Willow, really quick. I laugh all the time when, I mean, I know we're not doing a lot of travel right now, but when we get on the airplane and they say, put on your own mask before assisting others, you know, that really is true when it comes to the kinds of lives we lead as women, busy women, career women, family women, all kinds of things. And so we've got to figure out how to put on our own mask. And I think these are small steps to begin to cultivate that awareness that I've got to take care of myself in order to care for all these other things in my life.
This might feel like a very simplistic question, but honestly, if we're talking to people who are not good at this, and I'm not good at self-care, so I'm one of them, self-admittedly. You know, they might know self-care is a good idea. They might know they need to put the mask on first before they can help other people. They might think this sounds like a nice idea, but what does it look like for them to begin to actually do these things, actually take self-care pauses? Do they need to schedule it and put it in their calendar if they don't naturally choose to make that space and time for themselves?
That's a very good idea for people who need schedules, to schedule 5-minute breaks, you know, whatever that might look like. And I think all of us have 5 minutes. Sometimes, you know, like I said, we think, oh, I need to do an hour of this or an hour of that. And that may be just too much. But to say I can take 5 minutes to sort of begin to tune into what I need right now, that's important. And you know what? We don't know what we need unless we stop and sort of take the time to say, what is it that's going on right now? And I think that if we don't know what brings us joy, we're also going to have difficulty cultivating self-care, because I think self-care is to connect with what really nourishes us and what brings us joy, sort of uncovering the loves underneath the things that we love. So, you know, for some people, they enjoy gardening. And I think to think about gardening and think about what is the love under that, well, it's tending to things, it's caring for something, it's nurturing the soil. when you connect to that, you can say, okay, so what then do I need to do to sort of tend and care for myself right now in this moment? And that's where we just get so practical and so specific as to, why don't we just stop a minute and take a deep breath? I think everybody can take a deep breath. And maybe you can take two or three deep breaths. You know, it's as simple as that. But then, like I said, when we really stop and pay attention to what brings me joy and trying to bring that joy into our lives in small increments, you know, because we have the schedules that we do, I think that makes a huge difference. It certainly has in my own life to take a pause. Yesterday I was walking and I smelled this fabulous fragrance coming from a beautiful tree. I don't know what the tree was, but I stopped. I literally stopped. I went over to the tree. I grabbed its branches and I took a deep breath of that beautiful, beautiful fragrance. Just doing something like that, if that's what nurtures you. Some of us have allergies. That's not going to be helpful, but you know what I mean? It's those little things. It's noticing. And honestly, the cultivation of mindfulness is often a word that people get weirded out about because they associate it with a particular form of meditation. But mindfulness is just paying attention to the present moment right now. And as we cultivate that present awareness that's very focused on what's going on right now, that can really begin to get us going on a path of taking the time to nourish ourselves in the midst of chaotic and very busy lives.
I feel like we could do a whole podcast on self-care. We might have to have you back. Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to the second thing I want to talk about, but I truly am joking and absolutely serious at the same time. We need to have you back. The second area I want to bring up that I see a lot in women is grief and loss. We see so many women who are facing devastating loss and often cannot or have not defined it as such. They aren't really giving themselves permission to recognize the loss they've experienced and grieve. Why do we fear grieving so much?
On the one hand, I do think, especially for women who are part of faith communities, we are often judged that we should be happy, that we should be joyful, that we should be living victorious lives. And I think that pressure to be okay, everything's fine, you know, because I have these faith commitments, often prevents us from being authentic with the pain that we're experiencing, particularly for folks who are dealing with prolonged or complex grief. And so I also think we fear grief. So that's one reason why we fear grieving. I think a second reason why we fear grieving is because nobody wants to feel bad. It's a very difficult space to inhabit and to allow it to do its work in us and on us and then through us, hopefully, as we work through it. It's painful. You know, I think as we're thinking about wholeness, we tend to conjure up images of, you know, like the balanced and kind of perfect life, or wholeness means constantly always feeling content and happy and joyful and that everything's okay, when really wholeness is about being open to the whole of the human experience. That means the highs, the lows, the ups and downs, happiness, sadness, and really everywhere in between. I loved that movie, Inside Out, the Pixar film, about the importance of emotions and how they function and how all of the emotions were important, including sadness. So I think those are some of the reasons why it's difficult to grieve. But I think particularly for women of faith, we do tend to put pressure on ourselves that we should be getting over it, that we should be okay. And even while we have hope in the resurrection, if we're Christians, and in Jesus as walking alongside of us, we still are human beings who grieve and who experience loss. And even if we have the hope that we'll see our loved ones again one day, we still have to live in the here and now without them. Or, you know, in the wreckage of a lost dream or expectation for our lives, we still have to be present to that. And that's very hard.
you bring up a really interesting sort of concept about our experience in Christian culture, where in a lot of ways, and I see this all the time, I've actually written some blogs and stuff about this, but we sort of put this expectation on people that, hey, like, pray about it. You're good. You're healed. You gave your life to Jesus. You've been saved. So all is well. And we have a list of things that we say we value at Clyde. One of them is to teach a theology that is holistic. And when we say that, what we mean is that we actually believe that God cares about our whole selves. So we teach a theology around that. We're not just saying, oh, God cares about you marking all the boxes that you align with him in all of your beliefs, that God only cares about what you think with your mind. He actually cares about if you're having anxiety attacks. He cares if you're still sad after 20 years of carrying secrets of being abused. He cares if you are stressed out and running every which way. He cares about your whole self. And so there's an interesting, it's so true, experience as Christians where in a lot of the experiences we've had, we've kind of been told just to move on, get over it. You know, if God is with you, you should be good. And so then what's happening is we have all these women and men, for that matter, who are walking around just grieved and sad, and God cannot heal what we haven't been given permission to sort of hold out as hurting and broken.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I think that pressure is what makes it really hard to grieve authentically, to grieve, and just to be with the grief, to be present to the grief, which again is hard. Nobody wants to inhabit the space in between Good Friday and Easter Sunday, right? That Holy Saturday space is a very hard space to inhabit, but that is where sometimes we find our lives. That's part of the whole human experience. And there are gifts that come even in the darkness, but we have to be present in the darkness in order to experience them, in order to know them. And what we need is we need people to be able to persevere with us. And that's hard for folks. And it's hard for us to share when we're still 6 months, a year, 3 years, 5 years down the road, still hurting or still dealing with the after effects of a loss. We feel ashamed ourselves because we put these expectations on ourselves for what it should look like. And sometimes we don't feel that we have communities where we can, or rituals even, that we can participate in that honor those grieving things. And that's one of the things that I think is so important, is to create rituals around grief, markers, as you know, as it were, or touchstones that actually symbolize the grief to us and that can help us kind of live through it with this liturgy, with a rhythm, with a ritual that helps us not only connect to it, but then to move in and through it. I think about the Jewish tradition of sitting Shiva with people for 7 days where the house is just full of mourners. And sometimes I think in the Christian community, we don't have anything similar to that, even though that's a big part of our experience as human beings. And certainly in the life of Jesus, he also mourned and grieved and experienced loss. So I think creating the space and good connections with others who will allow you to grieve are really important. And then creating those rituals that can mark your grief and that you can share, hopefully not just with yourself, but with others who can enter that grief with you as you do that.
What are some examples of some rituals that you have seen people carry out that have helped them in their grief and loss?
Yeah, I think they can be as simple as creating a memorial. It could be a memorial that you create outside. It could be a kind of book. Like, I don't want to use the word scrapbook because I don't want it to sound like that, but to actually set up physical reminders. I'm thinking particularly of people who have lost loved ones that connect them to that person, that remind them of that person. Celebrating anniversaries with of things that not just of the person's birthday or the that when they died or of marriage anniversaries or things like that, if it happens to be a spouse, but other anniversaries, things that were important that you shared. I think those can all be helpful starts in terms of thinking about rituals. Burying a like a little time capsule of things that were important to you in a special place in your yard, or even creating a box or something to keep it in that you keep with you if you don't have a yard. I think all of that can be very healing and helpful to bring back out, to remember, to grieve again, and then to put it away and know that it's there for you, but that also is a part of it. You know, it, the only way I can express it is to say in my own life that has just helped me tremendously to have these touchstones, and these moments that I take to remember, the loved ones that I've lost, and to connect that way with them, even as I continue to grieve they're not being here anymore.
I'm going to move us to unmet dreams, which is also another form of loss in a sense. So many of us had plans and ideas and dreams, and, you know, we go through these sort of moments in time where we survey our lives, whether it's our 40th birthday or when we're about to have a baby or when we graduate from college or when we're, you know, looking at becoming empty nesters. And we can often dive into a deep place of regret and comparison and sadness that the way that we hoped our life would go isn't how our life has gone. How can we reconcile the fact that the dreams for our lives that we had aren't coming true, and then begin to redream?
Well, I think this ties very much into grief and loss. And I'm in counseling circles, we have what's called an adjustment disorder. And I think most of life is about adjusting. I hate the word disorder because all of us, we are definitely in this one together. All of us have expectations and hopes for our lives that don't end up coming to pass. So we first of all need to start there, that we don't know what expectations we'll have to let go of, but we do know that we will have to let go of some. In my own life, for example, it was not being able to have children. And that is a loss I continue to grieve, even as somebody who's now 53 and beyond that point of childbearing years, but still it's a real fresh, can be a very fresh grief, especially around Mother's Day. So again, I think we need to be able to grieve what we have lost before we can begin to dream about what's possible again. So I think the grieving comes first. But then I think to be able to sort of move forward and begin to start dreaming again is to sort of take these little incremental steps to break a bigger dream, like what can I hope for in my life, into small, measurable and manageable steps that will increase the likelihood that you'll succeed, because it's small, you can measure it, you can see, and that also can motivate us to keep going. But we can't even get there, Willow, until we've grieved what we have lost. And again, this goes back to what we were just talking about. Until we can actually grieve and begin to process some of that, we can't really move into the next step of beginning to even think what's possible again. And I think acknowledging that while you're grieving, there isn't going to be a whole lot that's possible, right? I mean, we have to acknowledge that this is a huge loss. Whatever it is that we've wanted that has not come to pass, it's okay to be in that space. And to feel as if I don't know who I am anymore, or I don't know what I have to look forward to right now, that's okay. And I think allowing ourselves to be in that space, we've got to recognize that that's okay. And again, especially speaking to women of Christian faith, you know, Jesus was a human being and he experienced loss, sadness. He was hungry. He was thirsty. Sometimes I think we have to walk 6 inches above the ground. Or we think that Jesus walked 6 inches above the ground when he lived a very human life, even as we proclaim him to be God as well as Christian people. But I actually really connect and have later in life more and more connected with the humanity of Jesus. And knowing that he was a human being means that I can be a human being. And that means I'm going to experience the fullness of what it means to be human, which again is the fullness of emotion, of experiences, just as Jesus did.
I have more questions for you around dreaming, but before I ask you those, I think with pausing for a minute and thinking about, because I hear you accentuating, we can't dream until we first begin to recognize and grieve our losses. For people who have yet to grieve their losses, what are, you know, the 1 to 2 sort of first steps that they can take to do that?
Well, first of all, I always want to be sensitive to the fact that some people might be listening who feel very alone in their grief. And maybe they feel right now that they don't have someone with whom they can turn or with whom they can share authentically about their loss. So for those of you who are in that kind of a situation, a first step might simply be to journal about your loss, to pour out your heart on the page. For others, it might be to do an art project that represents how you're feeling, if that you connect with that more than you do with writing. It might be going to an isolated place and screaming your heart out, crying your heart out. Those are all very concrete steps we can all take, whether we have people in our lives or not. But the second thing I would say is that I hope for people, you have someone in your life that you can connect with and can share authentically with, and that that person will be present to you. Sometimes that's a spouse, it's a partner, it's a trusted friend, perhaps it's a pastor or even a counselor. I know when I started to go to counseling, Willow, myself, sometimes I thought, gosh, I have to pay for someone to listen to me. And you know, you're not paying for someone to listen to you or to care for you. That's why we went into this work, is because we care and want to listen to people. So don't let that hold you back from finding someone that you can connect with who will authentically listen. And that in and of itself can take time. Finding those caring people, finding people that you connect with. But I think that connection is so important.
Yeah, those are great steps. I think about going back to this idea of redreaming. I find that so many women, even after maybe they've taken those steps that you talked about and walked a long journey of recognizing their loss and grieving their loss, they're still afraid to begin dreaming again. And it feels like self-protection, but what is that? What is this that we're doing that we're afraid to put ourselves out there and risk dreaming that there is some great chapter out there waiting for us?
Yes. Well, of course, I think you're exactly right. It is self-protection. We fear failure, perhaps. We fear that this new dream will not also come true. And because we've experienced one time, we think, oh, it's never gonna be there for me. So I think you're right. I think we do stop dreaming, or we curtail our dreams. We make them very small because we are afraid and we worry. But I think one of the things to begin to do is to almost take a view from the end of life and look back and say, what do I want to have my life have been? Do I want to look back and see that I stopped dreaming, that I stopped trying, that I stopped putting myself out there, that I just sort of sequester myself and protect myself? Is that the way we want to look back on our lives? Or do we want to say, no, I want a life full of meaning and purpose? And by meaning and purpose, that can be very mundane, ordinary, normal kinds of things. That it was meaningful for me to create beauty, for example, by tending to my garden. or it, you know, created meaning for me to do this podcast and to talk to people. You know, the range is out there. Some will redream again, and they're going to have unbelievable success. And I mean that both in sort of more spiritual and existential terms, as well as sort of the worldly way we would understand success. But for others, it's more just returning even to the normal things in life. And again, because I'm a gardener, I'm going to draw on my gardening metaphors. You know, after I had suffered a pretty tremendous loss, in that I was a widow at age 44, the thing that actually started me dreaming again was to begin to plant a small little garden. And all I had was a little raised garden bed in Seattle. I didn't have much space, but I grew radishes, which are very easy to grow here in the Pacific Northwest. And harvesting that radish, tasting that radish, I can't explain it except to say that that nourished hope in me, that there is possibility. And so that's what I mean by it can be these normal little mundane tasks that begin to generate hope in us for something bigger and something more.
Well, can I ask you, Margaret, after you had that experience, what did it look like for you to start taking risks to dream again?
Well, it looked like a very long, slow process. And honestly, it was a deconstruction of who I thought I was. And it by necessity, almost. You certainly don't enjoy it when you're in the midst of it. That's for sure. I'm not going to say to anybody that it was a fun process. It was a agonizing process. But like I said, some of those steps were simply just building routine back into my life. Because for a long time, when you're grieving, you can't concentrate. I couldn't read anything anymore. I couldn't pray. I couldn't do any of the sort of things that I used to be able to do for a good long time. It might have even been a year. It's hard for me to remember the exact timeline now, but it felt like an eternity. But when I began to sort of put some routines back into my life, and again, very simple ones, it might not have even been getting out and going to the store or anything, but just simple things around the house, that began to help me to see, okay, I can do this. The other thing, Willow, that's so important, it's very difficult to do when you're grieving, but that's so important, is to just, for right now, stay present to this day. What can I do in this day? I can't look to the future because I have no idea what that's going to be, but I can deal with the present moment right now. Right now, what is it that I can do that can make me feel better about where I'm at? And then that feeling of encouraging that can then help generate the hope that we need to begin to dream again, and that our lives can be something else. Not what they were, but something else. And I think about another metaphor. You know, what if you had planned a trip to Italy? You had planned to see Florence and all the beautiful works of art and the cathedrals and all that thing. And you get on the plane and you wake up the next morning on the overnight flight and you're in Amsterdam. Amsterdam is not what you expected, not what you wanted, and certainly not what you planned for. But eventually, well, here I am. I'm in Amsterdam. What am I going to do? How do I make the most of this city and learn this place and what it's all about? And that's where most of us find ourselves, whether, you know, whatever the circumstances, we had booked a trip to Italy and we end up in Amsterdam. But Amsterdam has its own charms, its own, you know, nooks and crannies to discover. And I think that's the way in which I want to sort of look at my life and the circumstances I find myself in, is how can I make the most of this opportunity, actually, is what it is. It doesn't feel like an opportunity, but it is an opportunity to explore, to be curious, and to wonder.
I love that journey illustration. You mentioned deconstruction, which is really interesting. The idea that you had to go through a period of deconstruction. I hear that term a lot. There's a lot of people going through sort of a faith deconstruction where they're deconstructing the church. And I find a lot of people are getting stuck with deconstructing, but not then reconstructing. And and I bring up the church, but I'm going to shift back over to us as individuals. It's the same idea that we can deconstruct things. And I find that if we don't reconstruct them, that's where we get stuck. You had to go through a period of deconstructing what you thought your life would be like. But I imagine there started to be sort of a foundation and walls and windows and sort of a reconstruction process. And slowly over time, you were given hope to believe that there was life waiting for you to live.
Absolutely. And I think there the key is remembering that it's not going to be the reconstruction of the same building. It's going to be a new building. It's going to look different. And welcoming that, even as it is different, you know, everybody talks about a new normal. And again, when you go through a period of loss and transition and change, you're moving into something new. So when I was reconstructing, and as that process was happening, it looked very different from what it was before. Some of my ideas had changed. Some of them, some of my habits in life began to change. You know, all kinds of things were new. And fortunately, it happens gradually enough that it's not too overwhelming. It can happen gradually enough, that reconstruction. But again, when we, I don't know about you, but the word new kind of makes me excited. Even if I'm in a place right now where different feels terrifying, because for it to be different means to move away from a life perhaps that I had loved or cherished, as certainly I did with my late spouse. So to move into something new and different, I don't mean to say it's like walking down a primrose path, but to know that the reconstruction can happen and can be something new that is equally strong, strong enough to hold us and beautiful in its end product is something that I believe is possible as we grieve, as we reconstruct. And I think the reconstruction process is essential. If we're only deconstructing, nothing's left, right? It's just a bunch of rubble.
Right, exactly, which is where I think a lot of us get stuck. I want to talk to you about anxiety. I just wrote a Bible study book that we have at Collide called The Birds and the Lilies, named after the passage in Scripture where Jesus speaks to worry. And in writing that, I did a bunch of research on anxiety, and some are saying we live in what they're calling anxiety culture. How are you seeing anxiety and stress running rampant in our lives?
Well, certainly in the fact that we're always, I think our interconnected social media, over saturation of information age has definitely created an anxiety age, because there are so many ways and things now that are 24/7 in front of us to make us anxious, to make us worry about the what ifs. I was just reading the headlines this morning and it's all doom and gloom. And so I started thinking, gosh, what if this, what if that, what if the other? So I see it running rampant in our lives because of our the information age that we live in. And also just this sense in which we talked at the very beginning of the program, Willow, I see anxiety and stress in the fact that we are so packed with doing all the time, and living very, very busy lives. And technology actually has contributed to that as well, because of the speed at which we can connect to things. That creates an impatience, that creates a sense in which time, if I have to wait 10 minutes, that's an eternity now. That causes anxiety and stress. We come to expect in all the areas of our life this sort of instant access, instant connection, instant whatever, as a result of just how we're being shaped and formed by the technology that's all around us. Those are just two ways that I see anxiety really impacting women.
Yeah. What are some sort of indicators that we might need help with our anxiety?
Well, certainly if it's interfering with your day-to-day life, you know, as you look at your schedule and you normally, you know, keep a really busy schedule, but you're struggling with, for example, panic, you're having panic attacks, for example, you're noticing significant shifts in weight, either weight gain or weight loss, either, and this is the same with depression, actually, and I know you want to talk about depression as well, Willow, but I'll just say that often anxiety and depression can have overlapping symptoms and indicators. But the big one is if you feel like you can't even do your normal day, then I think it's probably a good idea to get some extra help, to get another set of eyes helping you sort of identify the ways in which anxiety is really crippling and harming you. But those are just some of the things. Of course, irritability is another one, constant sort of irritability, anger, being short with people, not able to really connect. Those are all signs that anxiety might be getting the better of you.
Mm-hmm. What are some general helps for people who worry? They're just kind of worry.
Yes. Well,
and I say that as one.
Yes. Oh, and me too. I am an anxious person. I readily admit to it. And so one of the things that I've been trying to do, and we've already talked about this, Willow, so I can be quick about it. It is just trying to stay present in the moment. Worry either takes us into the past, right, with regret, worrying over what, oh man, I blew it again, blah, blah, blah. You're in the past, or it takes us into the future. Well, what if, what if, what if, what if, what if? And one of the things that I'm trying to work on and concentrate on is more the saying, not what if, but what is. What is right now, right in front of me, what is? Bringing ourselves back to the present moment is just key all the time. And that's going to be difficult to do if you really are struggling with anxiety in a way that is crippling your life, because it's almost impossible to stay present. So one of the things we work on in therapy is the cultivation of mindful practices that can help you stay present in the moment. And also to be able to then recognize when your worry is talking. To start saying, oh, that's my anxiety talking, almost to give it an identity, like, oh, that's anxiety again, and give it a name, and just to help you begin to, then you can pull away when you notice it, and you can say, okay, I'm going to let that go, because I know that's anxiety, that's not how I want to be, that's not who I want to be.
So good. So let's talk about depression. So many women suffer from depression in differing seasons of their lives, and some in all seasons of their lives. What are some indicators that we might be depressed?
Yeah, again, clinically, some of the factors are, again, pretty much that if it's clinical depression, it's really disruptive to your day-to-day life. And for at least 2 weeks, you would experience, again, either hyper or hyposomnia, which just means you're either sleeping all the time or you're not sleeping enough. You lose interest in the things that used to interest you. Again, weight loss or gain, irritability, anger, lots of crying, prolonged crying that you can't stop. You might even feel like in your body, like you can't move, like you're either really sort of slow or you might be agitated. Fatigue, loss of energy, and again, the feelings that go with it, sense of worthlessness, inability to concentrate. And then particularly with depression, that's really important that we look for are just thoughts and ideation around suicide and feeling like I just don't want to live anymore. I don't want to be here. Those are the big signs of clinical depression that we tend to see when folks are really stressed. Yeah.
If someone's hearing you right now, Margaret, and they're thinking, check, 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 you know, that they're resonating with a lot of these things that you're mentioning, what should they do right now?
Well, I would, again, recommend always the first thing I think of is to reach out to somebody that you know and trust and let them know that that's what you're dealing with, so that you have made someone else aware that you're really struggling. For folks who feel like you don't know anybody like that, then my recommendation is please contact a counselor or a pastor, somebody that's there who that you feel comfortable with. So sometimes that takes a little bit of time to find someone that you click with, but don't give up because there are a lot of people out there who care and who can help. So my main thing with that is to reach out. Reach out to someone who can walk with you through this.
Yes. And on that note, if that's you and you need help finding a counselor, you can contact us at Collide at info@wecollide.net, and we will help you get the help you need. I want to talk a little bit with you, Margaret, about, you know, there's depression, and then there's kind of this feeling that people can get, and I don't know if you'd say they're different, but kind of feeling low or in a funk. Is there a difference between the two?
Yeah, I would say there is, just in terms of sometimes duration, of course, and severity, how much you feel low or in a funk. Sometimes we feel in a funk, but we can still function. And I think the big difference between feeling lower in a funk is whether or not it's really significantly impacting your ability to do what you normally would do in a day. That's how I would say it's different. And all of us, I think being human, we can feel low and feel in a funk, but not all of us are clinically depressed or struggling with major depression. So difference of degree, I would say there. In severity.
I don't feel like I'm depressed, but just full disclosure, because I think it's interesting. I had this realization this week. I'm not even someone who I think gets in funks often, but I realize how easy it is to get in a funk, and kind of it starts to downward spiral. During the whole pandemic crisis, I was having to lay off staff and try to hold up Collide so that it can make it to the other side of this whole coronavirus thing. And my son got super sick, and I found myself fatigued and overwhelmed and caretaking, and I didn't go outside for 7 days. Not on purpose, just I was so immersed in this sick hole. And I realized how easy it is to kind of sink low and stay there or go even lower. And my husband actually started making me leave the house to go for a walk with him every day. And I was amazed, because I'm not someone who normally stays in my house for that long, but I was amazed at what some fresh air and sunlight and change of scenery did. And I'm sharing that with you because I'm kind of curious, what are some of the best prescriptions you could give us when we feel low or in a funk?
I can't give you any better one than you just gave. I totally believe that action precedes emotion. A lot of times, sometimes when we get our bodies moving, that actually helps to activate our emotional systems. It helps to energize them to come online. And so I would recommend, you know, a lot of times when we're feeling down and feeling in a funk, like you said, Willow, you wanted to kind of hunker down and just kind of stay in there. And it was actually in movement that you began to feel a little bit better. So again, we're talking about wholeness here. We are whole systems. So our bodies, our emotions, our minds, they're all intertwined. So even if the thought of taking a walk seems overwhelming, which I know when you're feeling depressed, even that can, set an intention to get out of your bed and move to another room. Just start small. But movement is so important, to do the opposite of what you feel, to say, I'm going to move for 15 minutes and then I'm going to go back to bed. Hey, so be it. Give yourself that reward. But to actually just begin to take those little steps of action and moving can make such a difference in our mood. I'll just say one other thing quickly, and that is to also be evaluating your diet. What we eat, what we take in can really impact how we feel. So are you eating too much sugar? Are you not getting enough water? Are you just kind of binging on the junk food? That's not going to make you feel better. So try to infuse, an apple, carrots, very simple, inexpensive items that can make you feel so much better. So be thinking about all the different aspects of your life and what might be contributing to your mood and feeling low.
So good. I could talk to you forever, Margaret. I'm going to finish up with this last of the six topics regarding women and wholeness. You know, women are the hardest workers I know, and they carry so many roles in the home and outside the home, and really feel the pressure of being super women and have to work harder to climb the ladder. And they run from being awesome at work to trying to be awesome at home, volunteering on school boards, being part of church, taking care of their family, other people's families, getting healthy meals on the table, spending time with God, investing in kids, getting degrees, working out, getting promotions, keeping up with friends. And the hustle can just lead to burnout. What are some indications that we're headed towards burnout?
Well, I think first and foremost, feeling hurried and harried all the time, like sort of that tyranny of the urgent, always screaming in your ear, you got to go, 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 go. So those would be the first two. I think also a sense of superficiality that you didn't experience before, where relationships and everything becomes very superficial because you just don't have time to go deeper. Lack of interest and passion can indicate that in something that you formerly were very interested and passionate about. A sense of really an inability to love, to care about others, because of course you're so hurried and harried and frantic. And then the sort of this notion of sunset fatigue, that everybody important to you gets the leftovers of who you are. Those are all indicators that you're heading towards burnout, in addition to, as we've already talked about, sort of symptoms of anxiety and depression can also be really clear indicators that something is wrong.
You just used a phrase, unless I heard you wrong, I've never heard that before. Did you say sunset fatigue?
I did, sunset fatigue. Well, it's not original to me, but just that, you know, when you get home at the end of the day, you don't have anything left to give to anybody else who is waiting for you, right, at home, wanting you to be present to them, and you just don't have the ability to do that. And again, think about it. All of us are going to have days when we're going to feel that way. So it's not one day. It's a consistent pattern that we're looking for here.
Yeah, you're really having me convicted over here, Margaret. Hey, what are some things that we can implement into our lives to keep burnout from happening?
Okay, here's the big, you know, $20,000 answer, Willow. It's at times we just need to do less. It's that simple and that hard. But it's really true. You know, I do think about Jesus and the fact that, again, as Christians proclaim, here's the Son of God. He's got to save the world, right? I mean, that's a pretty big weight to carry on his shoulders. But he only had 3 years of active ministry. 3 years. That's it. And in our, by our standards and in our way of thinking about things, that's incredibly inefficient. So at times, like Jesus did, we need to, I think, limit our availability. He often went off to lonely places, the Bible tells us to pray. We need to limit our choices. We live in a consumeristic society that's all about choice, and choice is often overwhelming because we have so many of them. We need to limit them. We need to limit our commitments in order to create the space for rest, for reflection, for silence, for solitude, and most importantly, I think, too, for authentic connection. So my big recommendation is we just need to do less sometimes. Doesn't mean forever, but we need to create Sabbath space, set apart space to do less.
So good. I'm over here taking notes. It's hard to interview when I'm taking notes from my own life. It's like free counseling right here. Hey, I'm glad I can make you laugh.
Oh, I love it.
Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." What do you think it looks like to have a relationship with Jesus that gives us the rest that he speaks of rather than adds to our burnout?
Yeah. And again, here we get at the whole core issue of our expectations. And I think most of us who are followers of Jesus, we do sometimes have this nagging sense in the back of our minds that we're still not doing enough for him. We're not good enough disciples. All these shoulds, oughts, pressure us into thinking that if we have an off day, like you just said, Willow, if we have a period of time where we feel that we're in a funk, that somehow Jesus is not there in it with us. And so I think to remind ourselves again, Jesus grew tired. He got thirsty and hungry. He wept. He got angry at the religious system in his day. He likely became frustrated with his disciples when they didn't get it. And you see this very clearly in the Gospel of Mark. He was often in anguish, especially in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he felt the absence of God, himself crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? So if Jesus can feel those things and experience those things, and those of us who claim to be his followers, we should know then, we should give ourselves the permission that we too can bring our burnout, bring our disappointment, bring all of who we are in front of him and say, Jesus, this is all I have to offer you today, is my funk. And that's okay. We don't have to be happy and up and firing on all cylinders all the time. That's just not human life. And that's not what God expects of us. I think the kind of rest that Jesus provides is the rest of abiding with him, which means acknowledging that he's there not only when we're feeling great and everything's going our way, but also in the depths, in the downs of our human experience. And that what comes to my mind is Psalm 139, where can I go from your presence? Where can I hide from your love? And the psalmist goes all the way to the place of the dead, to the depths of human experience. And he says, even there, you are with me. So allow your sense of rest that comes from being with Jesus to be that rest that says, I am a human being. And I have human experiences, and he's here with me in them.
Well, Margaret, I have loved our conversation. I love the work that you do. Thank you so much for being vulnerable with us and sharing a bit of your story of pain and the need to grieve and believe that a reconstructed story is possible. And I appreciate you making space in the midst of all that you have going on in your life to speak into our lives. And I'm sure there's people listening that will want to connect with you. Is there a way that they can?
There absolutely is. My practice is called Watershed Counseling Services, and my email is Margaret, which is M-A-R-G-A-R-E-T, at watershed-counseling.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Thank you, Willow, for having me. It's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, and for those of you listening, may you find the rest that Jesus has for you this week, and we'll catch you next week on the podcast.
Thanks for tuning in. To keep up with us, you can find us on Instagram at we.collide, on Facebook as at @WeCollideWomen, and you can also visit our website at wecollide.net to find our blog, resources, event information, and more. One last thing. If you enjoyed this episode, would you take a few seconds and leave us a review? It seems like such a small act, but reviews help us to keep producing this content and help other women find it too. Thanks so much for tuning in to today's episode and letting us walk with you as you seek and collide with Jesus.